Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. I'm Kevin Boileau from Epis Radio, coming to you live September 24th, the year 2019. That's 2019, with co-host Nazarita Goldhammer. Today, we are entertaining the question, is there an alternative to capitalism as foundation for a new moral theory? So, great question, isn't it? Most people take capitalism for granted. They wouldn't have it any other way. They love their money. They love it when their money comes in. Money has become the new idol. It's reified into semiological value. It's fetishized. Money has a fetish value now. It has the dubious position of being the archetypal signifier in our culture. Commodification, capitalism, acquisition, possession, the existential ontological mode of having. That's capitalism. It's just its newest form. And unfortunately, and I want you all to sit back three steps now, It is the glue, it's the leading value amongst all values. But not only is it the leading value, it suppresses, represses, and annihilates other values. A lot of times when other values compete with capitalism, capitalism rears its ugly head and destroys them. So a really super good example is President Trump's new signing of a bill that, with regard to the Endangered Species Act, in cases of disagreement and conflict, decision makers can now take into account the economic impact that an endangered species decision will have. Well, it's all over. It's toast for many animals. What that means is, and I'm going to give you a great analogy in a moment. What that means is you have all kinds of economic encroachments on the planet Earth. And those economic encroachments are industrial. And they're controlled by very wealthy companies, mining interests, large-scale agribusiness, fishing business, building development, anything that you can take out of the land, oil, is the biggie. Chopping down rainforest for more cattle land. So people make a lot of money off of these economic enterprises. And you got a bunch of people sitting in a corporate meeting wearing a bunch of stupid shoes, Italian loafers that were made from the killing of sentient beings, a lot of them wearing wool suits who were also made from the torture and murder of wool-bearing animals, sitting in a boardroom with their nice, fresh little haircut and their little Starbucks coffee, making decisions about making more money. Making decisions to make more money for their shareholders, and they don't give much value at all to anybody standing in their way. Clean water, clean land, protected land, Indian land, grizzly bears, wolves, coyotes, fish, turtles, frogs, eagles, hawks. The list goes on and on and on. They don't care. It's irrelevant. And that's what this show is about. It's about making prominent in the listener's mind how powerful this thing capitalism really is. It is now taken on godlike proportions. capitalism is the new God. Catch up, read your history, do your thinking. The new God, the new idol is money, capitalism, commodification. Vietnamese gangs in the middle of the night are stealing beloved pet dogs and cats, kidnapping them, stuffing them in bags, and selling them to the meat traders. It's rampant every day. So again, the quest for money overrides the value of a sentient being's right to be left alone and not harmed. So if you look at the history, there are people, critical theorists, who have really come to understand the power of a capitalist system, and super brilliant theorists who combine psychology and mathematics, psychoanalysis with critical theory, thinking about what we're doing. Piketty from France is another person. He's an economist, brilliant mathematical economist. He understands the math. And he's another critical theorist coming at it from a different way. So we're in this situation where capitalism is the new God, and all these corporate idiots continue to do what they do. They don't realize what they do. You know, I keep thinking of that line that apparently Jesus Christ made. He's on the cross and he's dying, and he says, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." But the problem is, we know what we're doing. Idiots who work in corporations have no idea of the damage that they do. This constant driver for more profit, constant driver, buying brand new consumer items, using pesticides in their lawns. There are regions in California now where there are no animals. You take part of Orange County in the Irvine area, it's been paved over. Look at Silicon Valley. Where are the squirrels? Where are the birds? So most people don't want to know more. They're what we call obscurantists. Other people, the near cousin of the obscurantist is the obfuscator, the person who's so afraid to look at the truth that he or she obfuscates and creates chaos. The person who's hysterical, who expresses and emotes, but doesn't solve rationally anything. The sadist, who enjoys winning. You know, sadism is not just causing physical pain to another being, which is horrible enough. But the sadist is also the person who smiles, has that smug look when they just made another pot of money off the backs of others. They feel like they're smart. They're not smart. They're just sadists. Usually the people with the money are the least smart because they end up hurting others. That's what capitalism does. It triggers our greed, triggers our anxiety. And then there's the complacent, the person who doesn't care and who always justifies his position by saying, "Look, I cut my lawn. My lawn's neat. It's trimmed. Look at my lawn. I'm following the rules. My lawn is cut. All the registration is up to date on my car, my driver's license. I'm a voter. I pay my taxes. I pay my mortgage." You see, that is the complacent person who is completely constituted by structure, completely constituted by relations of power. All these self-structures come out of a capitalist, violent topology. So if you have capitalism, then that runs the show, it seems really simple to make the logical move that all other values are secondary, subjugated, would be the right word, they're subjugated values, like morality. So do you want to live in a culture where doing what's right is always subjugated to the quest for more profit, more acquisition? Because that's what we have right now. And you're participating in it in some way. You have to, because you're here. No matter what you do, you're a participant. So I want to pass the torch here to Nazarita Goldhammer. And by way of preface, just to say, we're not going to solve in 45 minutes building a new economic theory. But what we want to point out is how the wrong economic theory can annihilate and destroy everything that's good in humans and all life on this planet, so that we can really lay out in a negative dialectical way the absolute destruction that our economic system is causing as a whole, even though you individually on your quiet little cul-de-sac might be doing well. You have to get out of your own narcissism to see this. So what we can do is we can start to make ideas. We can brainstorm ideas to think about how we rebalance capitalism and morality, or transcend capitalism. We can't possibly make the claim that we know all possible economic systems. We can't make that claim. What we can imagine, because we're creative, we were blessed with a transcendent creative function. So we can imagine, and that's how all good ideas start. You think about Da Vinci and Einstein and Bill Gates. All good ideas start by imagining a world without polio, a world with clean energy, a world with no violence from humans. So with that in mind, the question is, is there an alternative to capitalism as a foundation for new moral theory? Nazarita, welcome to the show. We'd love to hear your opinion.
Hi, nice to be here. Well, I've been following a lot about climate change recently, and there's a young woman, which everybody is pretty aware of now, Greta Thunberg, and I want to make sure that I have that right. But she had a really great quote recently, and it was on her, and that's Thunberg, Thunberg. And this was on her talk to the United Nations. And she said this, which I thought was really important. She said, people are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are at the beginning of a mass extinction. And all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? That's your quote, and you know, part of her talk was like, I should be in school, I should be learning things, and yet here I am, because all of the adults who are in control of the economy and nations are interested only in economic growth and money, to the extinction of other species, the very earth that we live on, and the human species. So That's the downfall of privately owned businesses and nations that all are in it for money. They're not really in it for the good of anyone. They're in it for how fast can they make money, rich, desire. So I started looking into what is at the heart of our desire to have capitalism. And at the really heart of capitalism started when, you know, people were afraid. They were afraid of being poor. And we look on poor people as losers. Like they couldn't get it together enough to make money or to be substantial in the community. And we scorn them. And we admire people who are rich. They become our idols. They're quote unquote winners. And so I think at the heart of this is the knowledge of how do you balance this out? Not everyone is created equal in creativity and ideas and ways of speaking and ways of doing. Everybody has their gifts that are very different. And maybe that's at the very basis. It's how we look at different gifts or how we quantify things that are that we think make us better. And I think that's at the heart of the capitalist system is that the marketing, now marketing comes into in the 50s, great marketing with, you know, catalogs and new ways of looking at things and industrialization of making people want and desire more. Because if they had more, they were better. They were looked upon as winners, you know, as opposed to someone who didn't have a lot. That meant that they were poor and scorned. So our whole way of thinking is this good and evil, you know, black and white, poor and rich, winners and losers, and it that is at the heart of the way that we think and the way that we act. And so we can't just say everybody's created equal. Like we all have this, and therefore we all should do this, because if you're really looking at a different kind of system, you have to acknowledge that everyone has differences in the way that they act, talk, speak, have creative ideas, the ways that they do things. And how does that enrich? How does that enrich us? If we don't think that it does enrich us, then of course we're pushed into a more black and white capitalist system of like, it doesn't matter who you are. If I make more money, I beat you. I beat you in life. And so I think that's at the heart. My view is that a moral system has to address the black and white thinking that we have, the good and evil, the winner and loser, the rich and the poor, you know, all of those language ideologies that separate us from seeing the value. The value is important. And in your book, Vivintonomy, this is an important step in us viewing social systems and different systems of moral systems and how do we bring morality back is to look at what do we value? What is our value system? If we think that, you know, obviously animals are no value or a big forest isn't a value. It's only to be gained in the moment to make us rich, to clear cut it so we can plant something that makes money, to sell the trees that make us more money, to build something that makes us more money. Then we're caught into that system because our value system is skewed to obviously money and growth, financial, economic growth. And what would happen if we kind of pulled the rug from under that and said, you know, what would we do if we didn't? So that's my view, is that it's kind of readdressing every day. I kind of get more information that causes me to think, oh my God, why didn't I know that? Like, why didn't I know? Like I've been watching Cowspiracy, which is saying that even these big dairy and meat companies, they are funding some of the more eco-friendly firms. They're funding them so that they look good, so that they can kind of influence them. And one of the big things in Cowspiracy is that whatever you look at, they're not mentioning cattle. Very few, a minute portion are mentioning that the cause of climate change and this emergency is cattle. They're not addressing that. And why is that? I mean, are they afraid to address it? Are they not making money enough to address it? Are they afraid of pissing off people who are wealthy, rich, and what we consider winners that can beat them? Again, the black and white thinking that can beat them, take them down, shut them up, kill them. You know, these are all things that we have to look at in ourselves, in my view.
Right. So thank you. I'm going to step in on this and just look at it like this. We have ontological fears. I think there are a lot of people who are tremendously afraid. And I think that we have a very underdeveloped culture. They're not cultivating the right values, not cultivating anything in themselves. They're just little replaceable workers. And that's very dangerous for a person if you work 40 years somewhere or somewheres, and then you finally get out of it and you realize that you're starting to get old, and that it's going to be a really hard road back to your authentic path. It's really, really super difficult to do that. And so people end up using addiction to overcome that fear and that anxiety. They drink, they use drugs, whatever. So we have a system right now that massively distorted by this sign system called money that people believe will be their salvation. You know, by adding a house or bank account or whatever. Money itself is nothing. It is a means. We live in a commodified culture. You have to have money. Money is the medium of exchange. However, we have a choice whether to idolize it or not. And there are people who only pursue money. Their whole lives are about gambling, so to speak, and working with money because they've created a fetish. And money is a fetish because money is just a concept. It's not really life, if you really think about it. It's just a concept. It's just they're mathematical expressions. So, all right, let's let that hang for a minute, and let's think about life itself. And I'm trying to dig at something in a kind of a slow way. But we have most people now who are so poisoned by living in this commodification system where values are provided for them on the internet and from the company. Values are provided. But those values are determined by the owners of production who manipulate your mind. They tell you that you need something when actually you don't. So now let's take one step deeper. Now let's look at things like a good philosopher would. Okay? So let's all be philosophers right now for a moment. Concepts like truth and knowledge and justice and fairness and rights, these are idioms that are anchor points in a cultural zeitgeist. And there are people who believe that these concepts really exist. If you press those people to define them, those people who try to define them will have a very difficult time. That's the first thing. So they really don't know what they are. And you can try by simply asking the question, well, tell me about that distributive justice idea you were talking about. What is that? Or what does it mean to have a right or a natural right? What is fairness? And you'll find that people very quickly stumble because they haven't thought about these concepts at all. What they're doing is they're pushing around words that create anchor points in public discourse. So when we think critically, we take that whole world or worlding, existentialists would call it worlding, it's something we do. So it's a progressive tense. Create a world. There's something that's underneath those anchor points, and there's something underneath the world that we create, the system of concepts, the ontological structure that we've chosen. That is power. And once you make that leap, because I've been trying to figure out how to teach this to people. Once you make that leap, that those great concepts like truth and morality and justice and epistemology and knowledge, all these really wonderful concepts that we even see in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, they sound great. Of course, people want to be signed up. So, if you can imagine that there are self-interested human beings who will stop at nothing to get their way, who are selfish, isolated, alienated, greedy, terrified, anxious, selfish, selfish people, who live in a win-lose mental economy. The other person has to lose in order for me to win. And we see this all the time, Nazarita and I do, in our conflict resolution work, our mediation work, our negotiation work. People have an irrational component of their self-structure where they have to win something from another person to feel good, to feel like they got a fair deal. And it's very difficult for some people to accept that others can win too, that we can have a win-win. So, however, most people will figure out, if they really sit back and think about it, that there will always be, in the system we have, people pawing at you, trying to steal what is yours, and always trying to hurt you and win something from you and harm you, because that's the way the system is set up. It creates fear in people, fear that they're going to lose what they have. So everybody's on guard. Creates a social psychology. But if you can make the leap, if you can entertain the possibility that concepts like knowledge and truth and goodness they don't exist in a vacuum and they're not foundational. They're contrived, human-made, man-made concepts that operate as a sign system, as playing cards, as pawns, in a system that has winners and losers in a capitalist economy. And the winners use these sign systems, semiologies, concepts like truth and right and justice, to win the game. So truth and knowledge are underwritten by power. This is a fundamental thesis of a good system of critical theory. That, and this is also, believe it or not, a tenet of phenomenology, that everything someone says or claims or asserts to the phenomenologist is just provisional. And so the phenomenologist has a very super critical, intelligent machinery in which they evaluate the noetic structure that underlies the claim. You do that first. And if you apply critical theory to phenomenology, you see that indeed claims to truth and knowledge and goodness are underwritten by relations of power. So a simple way, this is super simple, this is what I would teach to a 13-year-old, I would say, whenever somebody is propounding a system of justice, ask yourself, who wins and who loses? And once you ask that question and once you begin to answer that question, then you are on your way to becoming a critical thinker and a critical theorist. Who wins and who loses? So let's go back to you, Nazarita, and let's see if we can build a dialogue about why there is such an enamorment, seduction to acquisition and greed and capitalism. What's the deep down, like existentially, what's the draw, would you say?
I would say it's fear.
Keep going. Let's see what this is about.
Well, I think that and this view, I believe, is supported in our culture by marketing. It enhances fear in people to think that they will be left behind, that they will lose, they will become like slaves. I think that maybe there's a connection to the past culture. Like the winners are people who are powerful, who can take what they want, get what they want, and have more. I mean, look, took all the land from the Indians, right? And took all the land from many people around the world. The winners are the people who are more powerful, that have more. So this concept of having more, of being able to make decisions, not being poor, is at the basis of humans' fear of losing. And it's supported even more now by technology. Technology enhances that fear by seeing everywhere we look the supporting guideposts that say, remember, do this or you will be like this. If you want to be the nerd who doesn't ever get any girlfriends, you have to have this. And we buy into that because we see it constantly before our eyes. We hear it constantly. We live it constantly. Where people who are poor live in trash heaps. I mean, they live in places that are not beautiful. They smell. They're full of disease. They don't have choices. They're like slaves. That's what we're afraid of. When we've seen it happen. So it isn't like that's a theory. It's like we have seen this happen in our culture. And so this enhances our view of saying that the powerful have more. The powerful have more. They have more choices. They have more stuff. They have more things. They have more money. They are constantly on the go. They are constantly making more. And the ones who are the opposite, don't have power. You have less power. And therefore, if you want power and you want to make choices and you want to have a good life, you have to get more. I believe that's at the basis. So it's fear that we will be left behind, that we will not have that. We will be enslaved.
Yeah, fear. And, you know, I've always thought of that's a really interesting comment for me. I've always thought that fear is highly related to anxiety. And then I start thinking, well, you know, what's the difference between the two? What's fear? What's anxiety? Then I go sink a little bit deeper, and then I start thinking about, because I'm really into this, my transcendental faculty, my faculty that allows me to imagine the new, see possibilities for the future. What is all that? Well, that is this gift that the universe gave me and everyone else, was this phenomenological field, a way to connect with the divine, the way to connect with the earth, the way to connect with all other life forms. It's like being in the most beautiful place you can imagine and not being propped up by anything, but allowing yourself to exist as a separate being, but in intimate conjunction with the others, all the others. People fear that. Humans fear that. And that fear of this ontological, creative imagination drives people to stamp out the creative. It's terror. There's a difference between terror, fear, and anxiety. And I think deep, deep down, most humans white knuckle life. They literally white knuckle their way through life. And they look for ways to, and unfortunately this is the price we pay, they look for ways to avoid ontological terror, ways to avoid anxiety, you know, quickly ameliorate your anxiety with that bag of chips or that cigarette or that Coca-Cola or the beer or the porn, you know, all that stuff. Terror, anxiety, and fear. And then fear is a, I think, a cousin or a derivative of anxiety, terror. Fear is when you got, you know, the bear of some sort. It could be your boss, it could be your spouse, it could be your job, coming at you, then you fear it. That's just a form of anxiety. And it all comes from being afraid to be creative and afraid to be free. And so we have, it's my assertion, based upon my perception, that we have so stamped down true creative being, true imagination, thinking the new, reconstituting humanity, because we're afraid of it. So we have stamped down creativity and imagination and freedom so much. You know, what people call creativity in a lot of cases is not very creative. You know, if you give people all the tools and you say, well, these are your options here and you got to do it these ways, that's not really creative. That's total totalitarian system. Again, that purports to have a creative system, but it's being underwritten by relations of power. And I think you came up with an example once about children. You know, that you've seen children who are extremely creative and their creativity very stamped down by educators who just couldn't bear that a child could be more creative, because it completely eradicates and unsettles the inflexible person, the sedimented person's white knuckling. And if you were to sit down and talk to 1,000 people about alternatives to capitalism, I can guarantee you, in most cases, you would get a response that you can always trace to fear, anxiety, and ontological terror. So now we're in the heart of the matter. okay, now the discussion's got to where it needs to go. Instead of just discussing economic theory and moral theory, we've put it right back into the existential phenomenological. We're talking about the very basis of subjectivity from which we think these thoughts. That's where it's at, isn't it? Like if you were to sit down and talk to people about alternative capitalism, they would laugh it off. They'd think you're crazy. Isn't that so, Nazarita?
Well, I think a large portion of human beings would think that that's crazy because capitalism is built on desire, and most people are buying into the desire for more. So they would laugh at that. They would say, we have the right, that's the way they would put it, we have the right to embrace capitalism so we can have more, so we can be more powerful.
So we have a few minutes left. Did you want to make some more comments before we close? Do you want to bring it to the close?
Go ahead. I think you were actually on a really good track with what are the emotions that people have at the very basis of their decisions. I have a lot of thoughts even on our ideas of beauty that are becoming more narrow now. And are thinking about who
right.
is powerful, it's become narrower.
Right. That's really what we want to be talking about, isn't it? So
it is.
If you go back to even the seat of emotion, you think about what emotions are supposed to do, they operate as evolutionarily developed signals for survival and flourishing. They're based upon the German idea of mood. They're in part drives from our bodies, in part they're socially constructed, but they help us regulate our experience in the world, survive and flourish. And so therefore they're existential. So when you build an existential analysis of these situations we're in, we have to talk about emotion. We have to talk about mood, not just intellectual concepts. And I think that's the real trap for a lot of thinkers, is that they pull themselves out of the equation, when in reality we need to be participant thinkers. We need to participate in the discussion in an emotional, ontological way. We are all highly involved now. These topics about various crises in the world involve every one of us. We can no longer sit in a boardroom or even a classroom and talk about them as if they're just words in books. We can't do that anymore. The game has changed. That's existential. See, I recognize it because I'm a long-term teacher and we always think the existential. But we can't just think concepts now. We have to think in terms of participation, praxis, action. What are we going to do? How do we get involved? How do we feel? How do we think? What are we going to do? It's a very different way of being in the world now that we're called upon. You know, somebody can write a book about it. But the whole idea of philosophical contemplation doesn't work anymore. It's effete. It's weak. It doesn't do any good to sit under a tree and contemplate anything. We have to have radical discourse, argument, debate. You have to defend your position. We have to have plans, and we have to have praxis. So we're going to come back at this next week. Thank you, Nazarita, for being on the show. Thank myself. Thank all of our listeners. All of our transcripts are published as books on Amazon.com. Go to Amazon.com, look at my name or Nazarita's name. You can find the books. They're cheaply priced, well edited, and we're sure that you'll enjoy them. This is FS Radio signing out. Take care.